You are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXEI Tucson, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew. Today, I have a special guest to share her story, her background, her roots, and the work that she does in the community of Tucson. Thank you for being here, Alicia. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you, Tina?
I'm good. So why don't you just share a brief introduction and background to the listening audience?
All right. So my name is Alicia Vasquez. My pronouns are she, her, ella. I'm a fifth generation Tucsonense, and I call myself a Crip Chicana Mama from the Sonoran Desert. And so what do I do in the community? I do a lot. I think I want to say it kind of started down the street at 201 East Broadway. That was Scrappy's. I spent a lot of my youth there and a lot of time downtown. And I didn't know at the time, but I was really being trained for a lot of the work I do now in terms of being a community activist, understanding many different types of communities and people in Tucson and Southern Arizona. And I'm a trained historian. I was a first-gen college student, went to the U of A. And ever since then, I think punk rock was one of those things that kind of politicized me. And then once I got to the university, I realized, oh, no, I've been politicized by my life in a lot of ways. And so I've just kind of continued that work. Currently, I am the co-director of the Mexican American Heritage and History Museum at the historic Sosa Carrillo House. And I'm also the accessibility and communications manager at the Southwest Folklife Alliance.
Amazing. And that's so cool that a lot of your work is rooted in music. That's amazing. And Scrappy's. Wow. What an awesome place. I just remember always seeing how popular it was. There was always people outside. I remember the sign, even how it was written, the word Scrappy. what is one thing where you feel like, when did you decide or feel like this is the direction that I want to go in life? And why was that type of work important to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know if there was like a specific moment where I was like, oh, I'm an activist or I'm a community organizer. Surely it didn't come in that sort of language. I think it was just reading punk rock lyrics, right? Really? You remember getting the CD book?
Yes.
Or, you know, some of us are old enough to remember buying tapes. And, you know, you would open it up and you'd just read the lyrics. And for me, it was this band Refused, some Swedes. And I was actually just listening to them on the drive over. So like 25 years later, I'm listening to the same stuff. But, you know, there's a song called, I don't remember the name of the song, but it's just like another page in the history book, another lie to justify the lives we took. And I think lyrics like that really early on, bands like Gat Rot, like local bands. What's up, Charlie? you know, local bands also gave me that this kind of broader worldview that a lot of us from Tucson don't get to experience and don't get to live.
Yeah.
And so my time with Scrappy's, you know, I was 15, 16 years old going to city council meetings saying, you know, we need more funding for youth, having friends from all over Southern Arizona, not just from AmpFi where I went, but all of the high schools. You know, I learned how to community organize. I learned how to talk to people who are very different from me and organize with people who are very similar to me and, you know, recognize that we all kind of have a place if we have a common goal. And so I think my time there kind of just led to me knowing that I wanted to do something different. I knew that education was my road out of poverty. And so when I got the scholarship to the U of A, I almost dropped out after my first year because I was such an anomaly at the U of A. I'm on crutches. I've been since I was five. I have a lot of gnarly, beautiful scars on my left leg. And every single day in my hometown, someone would come up to me and say, what happened to you? And, you know, just feeling like really targeted and not necessarily in a bad way, but like people going out of their way to hold doors open for me and expect a certain response rather than, you know, I can get the door myself. It's cool.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And so education was like that double-edged sword where I did gain a lot. I understand the world differently now, and I see how a lot of the experiences that caused me trauma in life are connected to these bigger systems. And so I think maybe in that moment I realized, like, I see the world and I experience the world in ways that a lot of other people don't.
Yes.
And when I talk about what I experience, people listen. And so I've just been kind of going with that a little bit in order to find these commonalities. And I think I've been going with that since I was about 15 years old.
That's amazing to even hear, like, at that age, you know, doing the work that I do and talking to so many different people and telling their stories. I'm just so impressed when young people are able to have the confidence, the courage, and the support, because the support is greatly needed as a young person when you're facing certain difficulties or barriers, and you're not just thinking of yourself as a young person, you're thinking of the impacts of future youth. But that's amazing. And thanks for doing that type of work, even as a young person.
Yeah. And that's one of those things where, I mean, I still own shirts that I wore in high school. My punk band shirts, which I don't think I'll ever get rid of. And, you know, the smaller they get, they eventually become patches. But that's one of those things I tell a lot of my students and a lot of my mentees, is that it's not necessarily that you're better, that you made it here. It's just you somebody saw something in you and they supported you. And I am nothing without my community. I'm truly a reflection of every single person who has invested time, love, energy into me.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I carry that with me, which is why at this point, you know, public speaking or teaching about our home feels like second nature.
Wow, amazing. And when you were at the U of A and you were getting your education, what did you major in or what did you graduate in?
Yeah, so I knew I wanted to be a historian. So mm-hmm. again, those punk rock lyrics and AP history in 11th grade. I was like, okay, I want to be a historian. So I went to my guidance counselor and I said, what can you do with a history degree other than teach? And so he set me up to go to the museum, the Wells Fargo Museum on Stone across from the library. And I could have not been more bored. I was just like, there's no way on earth I am ever going to run a museum. Fast forward about 20 years, guess who's running a museum? I knew I wanted to be a historian. I love the past. I attribute that to my grandparents, my tata talking about walking down the streets of Tucson.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit of like one of his stories or what do you remember? Yeah.
My favorite story that he would share is his mom would send him and his brothers down to the railroad tracks whenever vegetable and fruit cars would come by, because they would throw out pieces of melting ice, like these giant bricks of ice.
Wow.
And so that is how his family would get ice. You know, and so you can imagine sending like a 5-year-old 10 blocks north to the railroad tracks to go get ice.
Wow.
So, and he told me all these stories growing up that I didn't realize until much later. And truly, unfortunately, about the year after he died, I started teaching Chicano studies at Pima.
Wow.
And it was in that moment at 28 years old, I realized, oh, man, he was giving me our life story. He was giving me the tools to survive in the desert, the ways that things have been, and the ways that community works. And so, you know, he would say things like, we might not have had a wheelbarrow, but my dad knew the guy down the street that had the wheelbarrow. So we all had a wheelbarrow. So yeah, I went into history and then I pretty quickly found women's studies.
Mm-hmm.
That's women and gender studies. And I found Chicana feminist theory, women of color theory, and then also disability mm-hmm. studies. And I pretty much became the most narcissistic academic you can imagine. I just study myself. The intersections of how these things work, how sometimes I'm the disabled person in the room, how sometimes I'm the Chicana in the room. And very rarely am I not one or the other.
They're just always that. Like, you're standing out regardless, whether you're not trying to at all, and it's just there, you know?
You know, Tina, I thought, like, in 7th or 8th grade, I was walking through the mall with some friends, and I had a leg brace, so I wasn't using crutches at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to fit in so bad, I said nothing, even though my brace was rubbing my ankle to the point where it was bleeding. And I just thought, like, you know, if I could just not make a fuss, if I could just try to fit in, if I could be quiet, if I could make myself small, I'll be accepted by mainstream society.
Yeah.
And of course, within 5 seconds, my best friend was like, oh my God, your ankle's bleeding.
Yeah.
Right. Just serving as that reminder. And so I think there's been a lot of times in my career as an activist, as a teacher, as a professor, that I've tried to make myself fit into these structures that just cannot accept all of me. I'm too loud. I'm too bright. I'm too whatever. And I've learned to just kind of be my full self in these places. And that's made this work that much more enjoyable.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm glad you found some kind of grounding in just what it is.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear a little bit more of the Chicano studies class. Okay. Let's go back there.
Yeah. So I graduated from the U of A in 2007. This is like, you know, the groundwork for this current border reality that we live now, right? Understanding the post 9/11 world that was being created while I was in undergrad, things like the Secure Fence Act in 2006, you know, it really did make me look at my hometown differently. So like people say Tucson is a border town, isn't a border town. We're kind of both, right?
Like, yeah, we're not I think so too. I agree. We are both.
We're not El Paso, but we're not Phoenix.
Yeah.
And so, you know, starting to look at things with that Chicano lens, understanding poverty through systemic barriers that my mom lived. So, for example, I was in class, I must have been about 21, learning about what neoliberalism was for the first time and learning about TANF, which was a policy passed by the Clinton administration in 1996 that essentially said, if you're on welfare, we get to ask a lot of very invasive questions. And so having my mom have to live that reality and me at the time not understanding, but as an adult understanding that, you know, that made me reevaluate the struggle that my mom lived as a brown woman, single parent with a disabled kid and another kid. And now that I'm a parent, I'm just like, how did she do this?
Yeah.
And so I think with Chicano studies, it gave me the lenses to look at all of that, but also to kind of see where we're going. And so by the time SB 1070 showed up in 2010, Show Me Your Papers laws, HB 2281, which banned ethnic studies, I was in grad school those 2 years. Yeah. I was not here on the ground with the Chicano studies. But I think what it did, if nothing else, it made me aware that our history is important. And everything my tata told me about being a farm worker, about Cesar Chavez, about his life, you know, that put my life into more perspective. And I think brought a different lens to organizing. So it's not just organizing what the mainstream wants, but pushing back against that.
Yeah. You know, with all that, you know, starting from a young person at 16 years old and then being a teacher and getting a higher education, and now you're at where you're at now, can you share about the work that you're currently doing?
Yeah. So it's funny because I have two jobs, right?
Yeah, you do.
Two amongst many. And, you know, I say that my U of A job is the job that gives us health insurance and is giving me access to understanding the world of arts administration. So I do that with the Southwest Folklife Alliance. And then the museum, I kind of joke, was like my side chick, my side project for a little while, which is terrible and sexist to say, but it was because I wasn't being paid. It was my heart. It was my heart work. And, you know, having, you know, a master's degree in history, I have like this very specialized training to look at the past, to understand the present, to better plan for the future. And so I think that that's what I'm doing, right? Like, I don't think many people have a place where they can actually implement their dreams. And I see the museum as that space. I see it again. I don't think I could have done this without being a Scrappy's kid. Like, I'm running it the way that I know how to run it. And that's based on community connection, of active listening. What is it that the community is saying? And I think also, you know, we are the Mexican American Museum, but what does it mean to be Mexican American today? And I think understanding generationality in these lands, language, immigration status, color, all of these things impact the way that we live. And I really want to exemplify that, or, you know, unveil it for the greater Tucson, because I do think that there's a lot of ways that our pride and being proud of where we come from has made us, you know, we've had to stifle that a little bit. And so I just want folks to feel comfortable being themselves. And so I mentioned active listening. And so our big project at the museum this year is called Survival and Resistance. And it's looking at the trichloroethylene, or TCE, groundwater contamination that happened on Tucson's south side from the late 1940s to the late 1970s. A bunch of different military-related industries, so the Air Force, Hughes Aircraft, so on and so forth, would use TCE as a chemical solvent to clean airplanes or tools, or to degrease things, or to melt plastic. Mm-hmm. And the employees were told to just dump it down the drain once they were done with it.
Oh, wow.
And so as early as 1957, the Thon Otham chairman wrote a letter to Raytheon, or to Hughes, saying, you know, whatever you're pouring down the drain is killing our livestock and harming our environment.
Wow.
And of course, understanding power relations then and now, unfortunately, that went unheeded. And mm-hmm. so what we have is a bunch of different cancer clusters and diseases like lupus, scleroderma, birth defects, trouble reproducing, you know, because folks drank and swam and bathed in the groundwater, mm-hmm. in the aquifer. And so we want to make sure that the story is remembered. My generation really doesn't remember this unless, of course, you're impacted. And there's also this silencing that I have found that happens in a lot of communities who have been harmed.
Mm-hmm.
And the example I give is I had been working on this for about a year and a half, and then my Nana passed away, and today is the 2-year anniversary of her death.
Wow.
So, but, you know, about a month after she died, my Thea called and she said, I found Dad's paperwork. And I said, what are you talking about? She's like, from the lawsuit. I had no idea he was part of one of the TCE lawsuits.
Wow, really?
Because he was part of one of the unsuccessful ones. Right. And so this is another story I've heard a lot, is that people who have been likely harmed from this contamination, because there's no quote-unquote proof, they don't actually link their sicknesses or their illnesses to the groundwater. And so then you end up not talking about it, and then these generational silences continue.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this is ever present, because I was pregnant with my daughter in 2018 when I was being served PFAS from those forever chemicals from our groundwater.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm thinking about it. You know, we're healthy right now. Hopefully we will continue to be.
Mm-hmm.
But this might be another time where history is cyclical, you know, because of corporate power, because of the desire for profit under neoliberal colonial capitalism. You know, this stuff just keeps replicating. And I want to put a stop to that. And one of the ways that I know how to do that is to talk about it.
Yes.
And so we're trying to tell this story. Also, just equally important, that not just that the groundwater was contaminated, but there was a huge fight by Southsiders that went door to door to door, collecting information, collecting data from their neighbors, from their friends, their family, whoever got sick. And so they did this work, this group called Tucsonans for a Clean Environment, or TCE,
mm-hmm.
In 1985, after Jane Kay, who was a Arizona Daily Star journalist, she did this huge investigative reportive piece to show that there was a direct correlation between the TCE contamination and all of the sicknesses and illnesses that happened. And so from that point on, the county, the city, Raytheon, the Air Force could no longer say, we didn't know about this, or no, not, that's not happening. And it's just interesting how it does take that community effort coupled with somebody with maybe a little bit more power, or different power, or who is listened to slightly differently,
mm-hmm.
to make some lasting change. And so thinking about the current crises that we're living in, you know, water is the most important thing here in our desert.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know that in elementary school, we had the Beat the Peak duck come to our school from Tucson Water and say, don't waste water. And I love that duck. It clearly stuck with me. But, You know, for me, that's also connecting the stuff to the bigger border issues. So why is it that Raytheon was able to pollute our groundwater? Well, if we look at the 1940s, the late 40s, this is the post-World War II boom. Mm-hmm. This is when we see a massive increase in Tucson's population, an increase of jobs related to the war industry. And we've seen how that has morphed over the last 70 plus years into the prison world and now into the border industrial complex world. So I would ask my students at Pima the first day, how many of you have family that works at Raytheon? About 90% would raise their hand. And this is at the Desert Vista campus. This is brown kids, a lot of first-gen college students. Then you ask, how many of you have family that work in policing, border patrol, corrections? You know, there really is this continuity of colonization from 500 years ago to this current moment. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge that, because the answers for the crises we're facing is also within those 500 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really grateful for my friends who are indigenous to this land for being so open to teach us, right? Mm-hmm. And doing so with love. I mean, my tata used to say, like, oh, yeah, we're one of the original families from Tucson. And right, growing up with that narrative is like, yeah, we belong here. And then understanding, like, no, we're colonizers too. And just sitting with that, you know, like, how can a Mexican be a colonizer? But, you know, that power that comes from exploiting the earth, the resource extraction, and then, you know, water. We're not going to be here without water. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday about how the Santa Cruz, just in three generations, went from a flowing river, my tata's youth, to being dried up in my mom's, to possibly disappearing in my lifetime.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. You were talking about this, what you're currently working on. I had recently seen the flyer that you put out, Survival Resist. That's like a talk or conversation with community members to the public?
Yeah. This is a conversation between kind of OG activists and the younger folks that are working on stuff. And I put this panel together with just knowing that there are people in this community doing work. And it just so happened to be all people of color from the Sonoran Desert. When that finalized, I was just like, this makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so we have Representative Betty Villegas, who herself has been impacted by TCE. She lost her sister to breast cancer. They have the BRCA gene. And we know that having TCE in your system also causes other abnormalities in your body to trigger. Mm-hmm. So Betty lost her sister. We have Eva Carrillo Dong, who is a lifetime educator, who's a part of a member of Las Aguas, and just doing really great work still, like bringing attention from, you know, water issues in the 80s to water issues today. And then we have kind of the younger generations. We have Nellie Jo David speaking about her activism as a water protector and trying to save Quito Baquito and, you know, the systemic barriers and the legal barriers against trying to hold your cultural spaces, just trying to save them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what does that mean? We have Desiree from Flowers and Bullets. Another just really awesome younger organization. I remember when Flowers and Bullets was organizing and starting up, and just to see where they're at today. They have a lot of knowledge with water, and, you know, they live in an area that's very polluted because they're right next to the train. They're right next to aviation. They're right next to moving trucks and giant trucks, you know. And so, like, what is it that their community is doing to try to bring the land back? Mm-hmm. And then the last person is Rebecca Perez from the Tucson Birthplace and Open Space Coalition, right? Working at the base of A Mountain, understanding what can we do with the Santa Cruz River if we can't, like, have it running because of the pollution, right? We can't have more pollution going further north up to Marana and beyond. And so this panel will be folks who can talk to each other intergenerationally, folks to share, this is what we were dealing with 40 years ago, but also to reflect back and to hear from the folks today on the ground, like, this is what we're trying to do. And I think another thing that just really stood out to me is, you know, 20 years ago, environmentalism in Tucson meant like Columbia jackets, those shoes that you strap to your feet. And right, like it was a very white hippie-esque space that wasn't necessarily open to barrio sustainability or barrio ingenuity that we've been doing for forever, right? Like the joke, like we've been green since before green was a thing.
Yeah, for sure.
You go to your nana or your mom's house and you open the butter container and there's beans in it. Right, we're green. You turn all the lights off, otherwise you get yelled at. And so I'm really grateful that this younger generation is also connecting these dots, understanding that our communities have been for too long not acknowledged and not seen as the bearers of the answers. When really I think it's flipping those power dynamics. Who should we be listening to? The people that have the least.
Yeah.
The people who have been here for forever.
Absolutely. Wow. That's amazing. That's good to hear, you know, those conversations, especially right now. It's an important time to talk about water.
100%.
Is there anything else that you want to share as we're getting closer to the end of the interview? Any last thoughts, comments, or even shout outs that you want to give?
Oh, man. Hi, Athena. Hi, Adam. But no, I think I'm just carrying my nana, my yayita, with me today, Theodora Petres Vasquez, because she taught me a lot. She was a polio survivor. She got polio. She grew up in San Francisco and met my grandfather and moved to the desert. I'm just grateful. I carry them both with me for everything I do. Everything that I do, everything that I create, I ask, is my mom, is my dad going to like this? And if the answer is no, then I'm doing something wrong, you know, right? Creating these spaces for our community, speaking in a way that they feel heard and they don't feel excluded, I think is just so, so important. So and I think in this current moment, Tina, we got to remember we're all in this together, whether or not we agree with each other politically or not. It's bigger than that. And we're seeing the effects of that. We had our first 100-degree day earlier, and then it, you know, dropped down to like 60 degrees. You know, this is actually not normal. This is not the way that I remember spring. And I do think that just getting your elders to talk, just listening to your elders is so important, because they're going to tell you what was, even though you're only seeing what is. And I think for me, the biggest marker of that is the checkpoints. So I remember a life before checkpoints. I remember a life going down to Mexico before 1994 and just saying, yeah, I'm a citizen, and walking back. And my daughter is not going to remember a time before checkpoints. She's not going to remember that water used to run in the Santa Cruz unless we keep that alive. And so that's why I tell stories, and I'm just super grateful that you're here sharing other people's stories too.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to come to KXEI and share your story, and look forward to just seeing the continuation of the work that you're doing and the impacts that you're helping make alongside so many other community organizers and professionals. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Tina. I guess I got to give the shout out to our website.
Yes.
So to find out more about Survival and Resistance, which is our year-long programming on the TCE contamination, go to losdestucson.com/TCE. That's losdestucson.com/TCE.
Absolutely. And I can definitely share a link in the description.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all for tuning in.
You are listening to Cultivating Indigenous Voices from KXEI Tucson, hosted and produced by Tina Andrew, featuring local historian and community organizer Alicia Vasquez. To hear more episodes, go to kxei.org.